You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after recent mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and three cities in Texas, we'll look at new calls to end gun violence, including ending open carry at some major retailers. First, think back to 10 years ago this month. In September of 2009, the Great Recession had been declared officially over, but it didn't feel like it for many Americans. Unemployment was still going up, getting ready to cross the 10% mark for the first time in a quarter century. And housing foreclosures were still on the rise, with 2009 seeing a record 2.9 million houses foreclosed. According to an estimate from the Federal Reserve, last year the crisis ultimately cost each American an average of $70,000 in lifetime income. Our next guest says the economic impact of the Great Recession was huge, but he says we should also pay attention to the long-term political fallout. Gotham Mukunda joins us now as part of a new series on the impact of the Great Recession. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Business School and the author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. Gotham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Do you think we've paid enough attention in the last 10 years or so to the political impact of the Great Recession?
Not even close. I think that we have allowed it to sort of fade in our memories as the stock market bounces up, and we forget just how much pain so many Americans are still feeling. And in that forgetting, we don't see just how much of what's happening in politics today, including things like Trump and Brexit, are probably a direct consequence of that enormous economic disaster.
In a piece you wrote for the Harvard Business Review, you said a fundamental turning point was the federal government bailout of big financial firms. What did you see in how the public reacted to the way that all played out?
So I think there was rage in the public, and I emphasize, and I used to say this to my colleagues at the business school. I'm at the Kennedy School now, but when I was at the business school, if you are not angry, you are not paying attention. And that I think is a pretty profound statement of the extent to which the American financial and intellectual and academic elite can be kind of detached from the way the financial crisis both affected most Americans and appeared to them. At the end of the day, the story of what happened to the financial crisis is, I think, as it's perceived in much of the public, and I believe that this perception is largely accurate, is pretty simple. A relatively small number of American financiers engaged in behaviors that were reckless and borderline criminal and were predatory. The consequence of their actions was the near destruction of the global economy. And the way the United States government chose to punish them for this series of actions was to give them an enormous amount of money. If you were an American whose taxes were going towards that and who was also a victim of the financial manipulations that had generated those profits in the first place and then found the equity in your house wiped out by the housing price crash that as a consequence of the Great Recession, or also just was laid off because of it, how exactly would you feel when you find out that the U.S. government seems to prioritize helping the people who caused it over the people who are the victims of it? That anger is both, in my mind, entirely justifiable and still lasts to this present day.
And you write that there is debate over whether those bailouts were the right move and the way they were handled was the right move. But in a sense, as far as the public reaction, it doesn't matter if it was the right move. There is this issue of the perception of fairness and lack of same.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's exactly what I said. I believe it's true. So I don't want to fail to give Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner and everybody involved the credit that they deserve. And that credit is real. They kept us out of the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario was a rerun of the Great Depression. So you should, so it is good that you did not get us, that you managed to stop that from happening. Where we should sort of limit our praise is I think they managed to get us into the second worst case scenario. One where, okay, we didn't have the Great Depression, but the fundamental unfairness of American society was exaggerated by our response instead of taking this as an opportunity to fix the problems that caused the crisis in the first place.
Talking to Gotham Mukunda with Harvard's Kennedy School, author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter, looking at the political impact of the Great Recession, he says, we should be paying more attention to how that has shaped our modern political landscape. Well, both parties were involved in different stages of the bailout. And do you think that people came to distrust both of them because of that fallout?
They did. There's no question that both parties were supported by the financial sector. Both parties participated in deregulation. It's fair to say that there was more opposition to it in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party, where there was essentially none. But the Democrats who were opposed to deregulation of the financial sector lost the election. They weren't in power. They were voices in the wilderness. And so I think people did lose trust in both parties. And more than that, I think they lost trust in the system, because what they saw, it might be, is a, you know, a profound pathology of modern American life. And it's not just limited to the financial crisis. It's just worst there, is the complete impunity of American elites. That essentially, if you reach a certain level in American society, you live a life free of consequences. So if you're a banker who managed to help destroy the world economy, and you're the CEO of one of these banks, and the U.S. government essentially bails you out, you keep your job as CEO. This is kind of astonishing. None of these people were forced out. Okay, but if you are – it's not just the economy. If you are a general in Iraq or Afghanistan who completely mismanages the war – you don't face any consequences there either. People, there was an old, it was a line in the army that a private faces more penalties for losing a rifle than a general does for losing a war. So it is not this problem, this crisis of elite impunity is not limited to the financial crisis. It's just worst there because that's where the stakes are. Because the stakes are so gargantuan.
Did that turn people, many people in many countries, toward a different sort of politician, one that could be seen as outside that system?
Absolutely. So we know historically that financial crises are followed pretty regularly by movements towards populist movements and sort of populist outrage. That happens all over the world, and that's a constant. That's something you should expect. And so in 1929, you saw a populist movement. You saw when the Great Depression happened. 4 years later, you saw Franklin Roosevelt elected on what's an unquestionably populist platform. If you ever want a shock, you should read what Franklin Roosevelt said in his first inaugural address. It is far more radical and far more harsh towards sort of elites, business elites, than anything Bernie Sanders has ever said in his entire life. Franklin Roosevelt talked about malefactors of great wealth. They were the problem in the United States. That's sort of the sort of language he used. And that was the rebellion we saw. But Franklin Roosevelt took advantage of that and took advantage of his complete control of the American political system, where the Republican Party had essentially been devastated by the response to the Great Depression, to create the New Deal so that the American public saw their government work that was on their side, was working on their behalf to meaningfully improve their lives. If you were in rural areas, you got electricity because of the New Deal. That's not a small thing. If you were retired, you got Social Security because of the New Deal. That's not a small thing. So they saw that the government was on their side when they voted for someone who campaigned against the elites who had destroyed the economy, even though Franklin Roosevelt, a Harvard-educated aristocrat, was as elite as a person as it's possible to imagine. So you do see this turn to outsiders, people who want to overturn the system, because your perception after a crisis of this magnitude is that the system is fundamentally corrupt. And again, that perception's not wrong. What we see here is that the sort of historical irony of our reaction to the financial crisis is that the outsiders who took power were far more sympathetic to the people who caused the crisis than the people they replaced.
Talk about how that's played out. You write about that with President Trump definitely running that anti-elite platform. And then what did you see happen?
So what we saw was President Trump during his campaign, if you asked American voters, who did they perceive as more moderate, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? They picked Donald Trump. And they picked him because during the campaign, he talked about doing things like raising taxes on the wealthy, punishing Goldman Sachs. He said that he would be tougher on them than anyone else, than Hillary Clinton ever would be, and than anyone else would be, because supposedly he understood them. We can wonder whether he understood them, but it is unquestionable that in office, he has been far better for them than any other president could possibly have been, from lowering taxes massively on them to tax preferences to right now, Donald Trump's appointees to the Federal Reserve are pushing to undo many of the protections that we put on the financial system after the crisis to stop it from happening again. So they are increasing the risk of the system at the behest of the big banks.
We're talking to Gautam Mukunda, research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. We're looking at the long-term political impacts of the Great Recession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looking back, did the recession change the way you thought about politics and who you voted for? Did you join or were you sympathetic with the Occupy movement or the Tea Party in part because of the bailout of the financial institutions? What did you think of those bailouts and supports for big Wall Street money companies, insurance companies at the center of the crash? Did it make you angry at one or both parties? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sorry, the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the political impact of the Great Recession. Gotham Mukunda is with us from the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see the Great Recession, the economic collapse, the bailouts of the big financial institutions as a turning point in your view of politics and the way you thought about political leaders, who you voted for? Did it make you an activist in one way or another? What did you think about those bailouts and the way the government handled them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Lucy is with us now in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. Basically, I understand that the banks had to be bailed out in order to prevent depression. But, I mean, the question is, why didn't those bankers go to jail?
Lucy, thanks a lot for the call. Gotham, I've seen this a similar analysis. Even if the bailout was needed, it didn't have to happen in the way that it did, and there could have been more consequences attached, whether it was jail or other consequences.
Yeah, so there are two explanations for that. One is a simple one, and the other one is the bad one. The simple one is these guys didn't go to jail because most of the worst things they did wasn't against the law. Now, the reason for that, you could say, is because the laws were written only after consultation with the bankers in the first place, right? So, of course, they weren't against the law. If you get to write the laws, you get to say what isn't legal. The bigger question is the power of the sector became so great that essentially the Justice Department became afraid to prosecute. And you actually had a statement by the Attorney General where he said, we are afraid to go after these banks because we're afraid of the systemic effects that prosecuting them would have. Essentially, he was afraid that he would cause a crisis if he went after them. So you had this sense that companies that were too big to fail were also too big to jail. And I would say that is a pretty again, this is the sense of elite impunity. Well, because you're this important, you're in some way sense above the law. Well, I wish we could have said that we could have found more prosecutions, and I suspect that a more aggressive and much better resourced Justice Department could have found them. It is striking, by the way, the extent to which the Justice Department has just lost interest in prosecuting white-collar crime. But the better thing to do is to change the laws in such a way as to make sure that this can't happen again.
Well, you also write – thanks for that call, Lucy. You wrote in your piece, Gotham, I think that when auto companies were bailed out, the government weighed in on who ran those companies in some ways. That didn't seem to happen with Wall Street.
Yeah, it's really striking. I mean, Simon Johnson at MIT talked about it as a quiet coup. He said if this happens anywhere else in the world, you'd say what had happened essentially was the government had virtually been overthrown by its financial elites because they got the deal essentially on the terms that they wanted. And this is just remarkable. When the IMF helps to bail out a country in a financial crisis, it insists that the leaders of the financial institutions involved be forced to step down. And the United States government did not do that. There was this sense that somehow these financial companies should be treated differently, that they were better. But in fact, I mean, look, at the end of the day, wealth is not created on Wall Street. The financial sector is an enabler of the creation of wealth, and it's critically important. You cannot have a functioning economy without a financial sector. But wealth isn't created by moving numbers around in a spreadsheet. It's created by people at Boeing or Google or Microsoft or Ford or General Motors, people in those sorts of companies who are actually doing things that generate value for their customers and for everyone else involved as well. The central problem we have at the end of the day is that the American economy revolves around the financial sector instead of the financial sector being the helper for the rest of the economy. The tail is wagging the dog. And when we change that, we'll know we've solved the problem.
Let's go back to our callers. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, I was going to ask a wonderful discussion and a wonderful guest. My question for your guest is, FDR used Joe Kennedy to set up the investment banking system that was undone by Bill Clinton as he tried to become a new Democrat and court Wall Street into the party. How do we prevent good things going awry as people try to get elected? And two, did the Supreme Court really throw a wrench into the whole thing with their using of money as free speech, and corporations should be considered also having free speech as prevent the political process from truly working?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Lots to work with there, Gotham. Let's start with that second point, the influence of political contributions, money as free speech, as Charlie says, on these kind of decisions.
Charlie, thanks for your kind words. I really appreciate it. So I don't think the Supreme Court made the problem any easier to solve. It made the problem worse. But the problem was already so bad that the sort of increasing of making the problem worse is sort of, you know, you're already dying. You can't get more than dead. Right. The way I would think about it is the problem is we think about campaign finance donations matter. They absolutely matter. But that's too easy. It's not a case of politicians being bribed. It's more a case of the fact that these people are so wealthy and so powerful that there's a thing in human beings that we just kind of assume that people who are rich and powerful must be right. I can't tell you how often you hear that, you know, this person's a billionaire, so they must know what they're doing. They must be smart. Well, I grew up in Maryland. I'm a Washington Redskins fan. I watched what Jan Snyder did to the Redskins. So I promise you I know that billionaires are not necessarily that smart. But beyond that, there's just the central issue is less the sort of campaign finance, although that's really important. I don't want to say that's not important. That matters a lot. We should do a lot to cut back on that. The central issue is that this sort of small sector of the economy is so disproportionately powerful that people defer to it whether or not it spends the money. And in fact, people go to work for it. So Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury who managed all this stuff, where did he go after he stepped down from Secretary of the Treasury? He went to an investment bank. That's where he's working now. And, you know, did that influence him consciously? No, I have no doubt that he's a completely honest person. I'm not being ironic. I have no doubt in his honesty. But subconsciously, do you think any human being could not be affected by the prospect of making tens of millions of dollars next year if they just were a little bit more sympathetic to the people they were supposed to regulate?
We are talking to Gotham Mukunda from Harvard's Kennedy School, author of Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter, looking at the long-term impact of the Great Recession on American politics. Back to your calls. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember the crash very, very vividly, and it never bottomed out, and it never did come back. And God, I got to catch my breath. We don't. This isn't capitalism. We live in corporate imperialism, and they've just, the small business is dead and gone for the most part. If you got a small business, maybe you got some cash flow, but for the most part, it's dead and gone.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. Gotham, in Eric's voice, I hear a lack of faith. I don't know if it was a loss of faith you ever had it, but a lack of faith in the system, and that was pretty widespread, right?
It is widespread. And I mean, I'd say my faith in the system is shaken. I've been very lucky in my life, and I have nothing to complain about in terms of where I've been and where I've ended up. And my faith in the system is shaken because I believed that the United States was fundamentally, at the end of the day, it was a just society and it would do the right thing. And then I watched this happen, and it was just horrifying. Right. I mean, it was bad enough. The Iraq War was, you know, there was like one thing after another. And then this was kind of the capstone of all of that. And so your faith in the system should be shaken. If it's not shaken, I mean, what type of a system are you envisioned that shouldn't be one that does this? The counterpoint, though, that I'd say is the larger process that we're talking about, this transformation of the economy into one that's all about finance and banking, is called financialization. And it happens to almost every developed economy. You can go back to Venice in the 1500s and see financialization happening. You can see it in Great Britain in the 19th century and the 20th century. There is exactly one example of a highly financialized economy that steps back from the brink and reforms itself into a much healthier one. So the fact that there's only one should worry us, but what should make us feel hopeful is that one is the United States. We did it. During and after the Great Depression, we created a set of rules and regulations that brought the financial sector back into its proper balance with the rest of the economy and created, you know, a middle class like none the world had ever seen before. If we did it once, we are perfectly capable of doing it again. And that's what we should be trying for.
That's one response. Another response out there is that real misbehavior by elites fuels conspiracy theories, extremist politics that have always bubbled under the surface and gives them new energy. Do you worry about that as the alternative if those changes aren't made?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, even if the changes are made, that will happen. The suffering caused by the crisis is real, and people turn to conspiracy theories naturally in that context. But they'll do so much more so if they don't believe that the system is on their side. Right. If you have to have some sort of an explanation why the world's sort of oldest, richest and most stable democracy is somehow not on the side of the people who cast the votes. And that's certainly how it appears to most Americans. So, yeah, I mean, the fundamental health of the American political system is at risk. And it's not just at risk because of Donald Trump. Trump is as much a symptom as he is a cause of this crisis. It is at risk because if Americans stop believing that the system will deliver for them, then they will stop participating in it and they will turn to something else. We need to fix the system, not because it's economically good, although it would be economically good. We'd all be better off for it. We need to fix the system because the survival of our of a democratic society depends on it. When Barack Obama gave a speech to the CEOs of the major Wall Street banks, he said to them, "I am the only thing standing between you and pitchforks." I think that was true in a lot of senses. I used to say to my colleagues, you guys don't understand how things are, what things are like out there. If Obama had said during his inaugural address, you know, my reform, financial reform plan is to hang investment bankers from lampposts in Manhattan, a big chunk of the country would have said, let's give it a try. I'm not saying that's a good thing. We don't want that kind of attitude. We don't want pitchforks. But the rage was real. What I have to say is that we need to tell people that, you know, you should we understand why you feel angry, but don't turn against the system because the system, even if it failed then, is going to fix itself. It's going to end up, it's going to make things right.
Gautam, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Gautam Mukunda, research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. He joins us today for a look at the long-term political impact of the Great Recession. He says we're still feeling it today. Now, after recent mass shootings in Texas and Ohio and other gun violence around the country, some major retailers are taking steps aimed at curbing the problem. 2 weeks ago, 22 people were shot and killed at an El Paso Walmart in the surrounding area. In July, a disgruntled Walmart employee in Mississippi killed two coworkers and injured a police officer. On Tuesday, Walmart said it would no longer sell short-barrel rifle ammunition and announced it would ban the sale of handguns in Alaska, the last place it allowed them to be sold. And Walmart, as well as Kroger's and now CVS and Walgreens, are asking customers not to openly carry in their stores, even in states where it's legal. In a statement, Walmart CEO Doug McMillon said, quote, "We've been listening to a lot of people inside and outside our company as we think about the role we can play in helping to make the country safer. It's clear to us that the status quo is unacceptable." Here in Wisconsin, the latest Marquette University Law School poll shows voters strongly support background checks on all gun sales, but whether state or federal lawmakers pursue such legislation remains to be seen. Robert Spitzer is a distinguished service professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the State University of New York at Cortland. His books include The Politics of Gun Control. Bob, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you.
Well, we've talked a lot over the years about federal and state gun policies. I don't know if we've talked about retail stores weighing in on this. What do you make of this trend, apparently, big chains changing their firearm policies?
Well, this is an interesting step, but it's not a new idea. It's not something I think we've talked about before, but this has been bubbling around really for several years. You can go back to the early part of this decade when a mother's group decided to organize and put economic pressure on various chain restaurants, stores, places like Starbucks, Target, other places, for one thing, to get them to stop allowing people to carry weapons legally in their places of business. Because even if you live in a state where it's legal to carry a gun either concealed or open carry, places of business have a right to prevent you from entering their places of business. And what typically occurs in other states is that you put a sign in the window saying, you know, no gun carrying in our store. And that's perfectly allowable. So Walmart taking this step is significant. It's certainly a huge national retailer. They have, I think, something like 4,600 stores across the country. And the people who own and run Walmart, they're, you know, politically kind of on the conservative side, and business people tend to be generally conservative and cautious in the most general sense. So the fact that they're taking these steps, I think, is significant. They have done some other things in the past along these lines. Back in 2015, Walmart stopped selling assault rifles, but they didn't make a real big deal about it. And a final interesting thing, there was I saw some survey results today or yesterday that reported that the public had a positive feeling about Walmart taking these steps. And my guess is that Walmart and many other companies that have moved along these lines have pre-tested these things. And they know that the public at large is generally sympathetic to these measures because they're not, after all, in the business of politics per se. They're in the business of commercial business, commercial enterprise. But they do have a conscience. They are looking around at what's happening. And of course, as you mentioned in your setup, Walmart was the site of one of the shootings in Texas at the beginning of August. And 2 days before that, two of their managers in Mississippi were shot and killed. So this is right at the doorstep of Walmart as well.
The National Rifle Association responded to this Walmart decision. They said in a Facebook post, quoting, "It is shameful to see Walmart succumb to the pressure of the anti-gun elites. Lines at Walmart will soon be replaced by lines at other retailers who are more supportive of America's fundamental freedoms." Does the NRA have that kind of sway over not voting now, but on where people shop?
Well, I don't think very much. They certainly are. Their message is received by their members and those who, you know, follow the NRA point of view. But in terms of
We're losing our connection with Robert Spitzer. We'll try bringing him on in another way, maybe via phone. We're talking to Robert Spitzer. His books include The Politics of Gun Control, looking at some of the most recent news after the latest round of mass shootings in places around the country. We've been talking about retailers changing their firearm policies, including asking customers not to openly carry firearms in their stores. In just a few minutes, we're going to talk about public opinion on gun laws, and whether there is a chance to change laws on things like background checks, assault weapon bans, red flag laws at the state or federal level. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email your thoughts, ideas@WPR.org. We'll come back to that conversation in just a few minutes here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with political scientist and gun policy expert Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York at Cortland. We're talking about renewed pushes for gun control measures after multiple mass shootings in recent weeks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it's going to take to reduce gun violence? Are expanded background checks and red flag laws part of the solution? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert, we were talking earlier about the influence of the National Rifle Association. They have had some internal difficulties and friction that maybe some people are saying affect their political influence. What's going on there?
Yeah, they have. They really are being besieged from all sides. They suffered politically after the 2018 midterm elections when a lot of candidates around the country campaigned on an expressly pro-gun safety agenda and were elected, as if to say, look, you guys don't scare us anymore, meaning the NRA. They have severe financial problems, and there's been a lot in the news about that stuff. Some very extravagant spending. They severed their ties with their advertising firm, Alexander McQueen, that they'd been doing business with for over 40 years. I mean, in 2017 alone, though, they paid them $40 million to do, you know, whatever it is that they did for them. And they've now severed that tie. They're in expensive, nasty litigation with them. The New York State Attorney General's office is investigating them. They've subpoenaed people. There are congressional investigations, a lot of financial questions. Their tax status is being examined, possible ties with Russia, and did they funnel money from the Russians to the 2016 political campaigns, which if they did, is strictly illegal. So they've got an awful lot of bad stuff going on for them, and some of it, frankly, is just their own fault, money mismanagement. But the messaging to the gun rights community, of course, continues. And those people are still in Wisconsin and all around the country, and they still have their beliefs and will express them as they had before. But in terms of the NRA as a funding organization, providing big money to candidates running for office coming up to 2020, in terms of lobbying activities, traditional activities, they're just not going to have the resources to do it. There's no way they can spend the kind of money in 2020 that they did in 2016, and they're just not going to be sitting at the table with the other big money players, especially for President Trump and others. So that's a big, big problem for them.
Before we go to our callers, we have a new polling from the Marquette University Law School. We talked about that on the show yesterday. 80% of Wisconsin voters support background checks on all firearm sales. That includes most gun owners as well. Red flag law is getting a lot of support. During a news conference last week, Governor Tony Evers said he's leaning toward calling a special session of the legislature to take up gun control measures. Here's a listen.
It's going to be a matter of time if we come to the conclusion that the Republicans aren't going to come into session and do something proactive, such as something that 80% of the people of Wisconsin want, and that's universal background checks. We'll have a special session.
So we have a Democratic governor, Republican control of the legislature. What are you watching for in states like Wisconsin, Bob?
Well, Wisconsin really is kind of a testing ground. Measures like red flag laws have spread across the country. There are, I believe, now 17 states that have enacted them, and that includes pretty conservative states with conservative governors in some cases. Universal background checks is a measure that everybody, you know, virtually everybody supports. The idea is that around 22% of all gun sales occur without any background check because they're between private individuals. And obviously those individuals could be people like the recent shooter in Texas who was denied the ability to buy a gun legally, and he wound up buying it through a private no background check sale. I mean, that's kind of an exemplar of the sort of problem that can arise. So these are measures, and even President Trump, who's really waffled all over the place on where he really stands on gun measures, has at various times indicated support for strengthened background checks and even the idea of red flag laws and other things. Of course, it's hard to know where he's going to come out on all that. But in places like Wisconsin and other states, there's more and more momentum, and I think more and more public unrest about the fact that federal government and most states have really not acted, and I think that pressure is just going to build.
Let's go to our callers now. Gene joins us in Richland Center. Gene, hi.
Howdy. Just wanted to make a point that a lot of people forget is that the assault weapons ban is what y'all are looking at doing again. Back in 99, when Columbine happened, those guns were actually banned in 94. So banning is not going to solve the problem. Neither is, I believe in concealed carry. I think that what Walmart's doing is, for anybody that is going to be carrying, you should be carrying concealed, because why would you make yourself a target, first and foremost? I mean, that's kind of an obvious thing. And then as far as background checks goes, I would say that, honestly, whenever a gun passes from one hand to another, whether it's family or anybody, I do believe that it should go through a store owner. So that way, or a firearms owner, or I'm having a moment there.
But, Gene, I'm going to jump in because you gave us a lot to talk about. We haven't talked much about assault weapon bans so far. Bob, are people talking about that again now?
There is some movement or some discussion about that. There's a congressional committee that just is maybe taking that matter up at the end of September. I would just backtrack a little bit first. Gene makes a real good point that even two private individuals, you know, you have a neighbor, let's say you want to sell a gun to somebody you know, it's simple enough to make the sale, fill out a one-page form, take the form to your local gun dealer, your licensed dealer, who can run the background check. That, in fact, happens to be the law in New York State, where I live, and a few other states have it, but not at the federal level. And in terms of assault weapons ban stuff, obviously that's a pretty, you know, that's a further reach for people who want to see stronger gun laws. There is a new study out about the assault weapons ban from 1994 to 2004, the federal law, that actually showed that the use of such weapons declined in crimes during that period of time and then really shot up after 2004, suggesting that it may have actually had some beneficial effect. But, of course, most gun crimes are not committed with assault weapons to begin with, although they are favorites of mass shooters.
Thanks a lot for that call, Gene. And you recently wrote a piece, Bob, on large-capacity magazines, basically weapons that can have lots of ammo. You can fire more without reloading. Why did you focus in on that?
Well, the magazines question is important because a magazine is not a weapon. It's an accessory. Now, there are weapons, of course, that cannot operate unless you have a magazine inserted, including so-called assault weapons. And the question then is how big a magazine? And we know, for example, that the Ohio shooter from the beginning of August had a 100-round drum magazine that he used and fired off, killed and wounded a whole bunch of people in the space of 30 seconds before the police stopped him. And you can have all kinds of weaponry, but if you impose stricter limits on magazines, it's a simple thing to do. There are a lot of them out there, to be sure. But, you know, if your basin is filling up with water because you have a broken pipe, first thing you do is turn off the water. If you decide that as a matter of policy, it'd be useful to not have 100-round drum magazines or 40-round magazines floating around, well, you could stop them and then begin the process of preventing future sales, and you can cut back on them over time. And frankly, it's hard to come up with a very good reason why anybody, certainly no sports person or hunter, you know, needs to have a large capacity magazine beyond, say, 10 rounds. And that we know that in actual shooting circumstances, that kind of thing makes a difference.
Thanks again for the call, Gene. We'll go now to David with us in Duluth. David, hi.
Yes, hi. Say, you know, I recently affected by a couple of different suicides that acquaintances from handguns. Seems to be a societal problem more than anything right now. But if you look at some of the statistics to the ATF, and the amount of gun-related deaths in the United States has went from 12,000 to 22,000 in just the span of 20 years. And that kind of correlates to the amount of weapons that were sold. 2007, it was 11.2 million. 2017, 25.2 million handguns. And I would just have to say the proximity of having a handgun available is contributing to probably a lot of suicide deaths.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Bob, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but David, one number that's definitely true, the majority, as I understand it, of firearm deaths are related to suicide.
Yeah, David makes an extremely important point. Annually, there are twice as many gun suicides as there are gun homicides. And that is an alarming and disturbing statistic. And indeed, it is the one element of, you know, harm that guns do, that is gun suicides, that is highly correlated with gun frequency. When there's a lot of guns in an area, the gun suicide rate goes up. And the subject of red flag laws we mentioned earlier, which allows, let's say, a relative or an intimate of a person who owns guns, and if they think that person is either homicidal or makes specific threats or is suicidal, they can go to the police and get a temporary order to have the guns removed, have the person examined, go before a judge, determine whether they should keep their guns or not. And there have already been some studies that have demonstrated that these red flag laws in states where they have existed have produced reductions in suicides in those states. That is a tremendously important point.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York at Cortland, author of the book The Politics of Gun Control, looking at the latest politics of gun control at the state and federal and retail levels. Back to your calls. Phil is with us in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Phil, hello.
Hello. I was just wondering if you could have a show where you talk about the profits the gun industry makes every year and how they spend that money, especially how they spend it with politicians and the effect that has, the lobbying. We're always talking about these things like background checks and magazines and banning a gun. But those things never really happen, and if they do, they're reversed the next time there's a Republican in office. And the money is the basis of the problem.
Phil, thanks for the call. Bob, the economics of the gun industry.
Well, certainly the gun industry is a major contributor, participant along with the NRA and their activities. They do contribute, you know, a lot of money to their causes. Although the gun industry itself is not all that profitable. Part of the problem is what they produce. And I don't mean people being scared of guns. I mean the fact that firearms are a very durable commodity. You know, if a firearm wore out after a year or two, the gun industry's profitability would probably be a lot greater. But, you know, firearms with a minimal degree of care can last for not only years, but decades. As a consequence, they are, you know, looking for other kinds of profits. And that's one reason why they really went all in selling assault weapons in the early 2000s, because the profit margin on assault weapons is greater, and you have a lot of accessories that go with those kinds of weapons. But the money angle is certainly very important. Phil's right.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to turn to what's going on at the federal level now. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told conservative talk show host Hugh Hewitt this week that he would bring gun control legislation to the floor if it had President Trump's support. Here's a listen.
If the president took a position on a bill so that we knew we would actually be making a law and not just having serial votes, I'd be happy to put it on the floor. And the administration is in the process of studying what they're prepared to support, if anything.
And as you mentioned earlier, Bob, the president has given mixed signals on various gun-related measures. What are you watching for in Congress?
Well, Senate, of course, is where the focus is, because the House of Representatives has enacted several gun measures already, and they're considering others. I find that the quote by Majority Leader McConnell to be kind of sad, and the reason why is not whether he opposes or supports gun laws. It's the fact that he simply is content to say, well, let's see what President Trump says, and that will determine what the United States Senate will do, a co-equal branch of government. And, you know, if he believed in the cause of, you know, supporting that legislation, or at least allowing it to come to the floor of the Senate for debate and vote, that would at least be the Senate functioning as an independent branch of government, and the president could then exercise his constitutional power to either sign such legislation or veto it or express his opinion publicly. But to sort of sit back and wait for President Trump to make his decision, who, of course, has gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth on this issue, I think is just Senator McConnell saying, well, we're not really the United States Senate. We're just kind of an appendage of the sitting president. And I don't care what your party is or your ideology or how you feel about the gun issue. That's not how the branches of government are supposed to operate.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Okay, good to be with you.
That's Robert Spitzer, distinguished service professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the State University of New York at Cortland. He's been following issues of gun control in American politics for many years, written books on the subject. He joins us for a look at the latest at the state level, in the federal government, and what's going on at retail chains, places like Walmart, Kroger, CVS, Walgreens, changing their policies when it comes to open carry of firearms, among other things, in their stores. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's a lot of food waste around the world, over 1 billion tons a year. Our guest shares a plan to cut global food waste in half. As college football season heads into high gear, we'll meet the new director of the UW-Madison Marching Band. He's picking up a whole new piece of a long-running tradition. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A cookbook author tells us how to add the deep, rich flavor called umami to any kind of dish, from soup to cake. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.